Thanks, Tomo. It's really great to be standing in front of you again. Sorry if it hasn't been so frequent in the last year or two. I think the work side was quite demanding, but it's just a privilege to minister from God's word, to minister to hearts this morning. It's got more of a heart message than a head message this morning, and I really feel God has a word for us coming through in the worship, in what Andrew was saying. So if you could just prepare your hearts in front of him. I think my point of departure is from a short clip that I shared over the Christmas break. We released it just in January, just at the start of the new year. Each of the elders said something. And we were out on holiday in Komaki, and I'd gone for a walk in the morning, and it was one of those beautiful, clear mornings. So it's one of these beautiful, clear mornings in Komaki, walking along that boardwalk to the lighthouse. I just felt God say to me that lighthouse, it stands as a beacon for us to look up to, the same way we need to look up to God when we're surrounded by the wind and the waves and the rain lashing down on the water. We can choose to either be preoccupied with what's around us, struggling in our own strength to fight through the waves, to make our way, or we can choose to look up to a sure and steady point that's consistent, that'll warn us of the dangers and see us safely through. And obviously my mind goes straight from that to Psalm 121, the psalm I know well. And in that, it's a psalm of ascent. And the psalmist is saying, I lift my eyes up to the hills. From where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your keeper. He is your shade on your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all evil. He will keep your life. The Lord will keep your going out and your coming in from this time forth and forevermore. So this picture that we've got, if we can flash up the second picture of the lighthouse, the one I gave you at night in a storm, this is the image that I've got of us needing to look up to God when we're in that storm. And now if we can go to the first picture of the trail on the road to Jerusalem. This is where we are in the... Yeah, there you go. So this is what it's like, walking on the road. This trail is still here, just like this. It goes from Jericho to Jerusalem. It would have been one of these trails that this psalmist was walking, and this is why it's called a song of ascent, because they're walking up the hills, quite literally. And as this psalmist is walking up this on this journey, he starts to form this metaphor of looking for help, looking up to the hills. Where does his help come from? My help comes from the Lord, and it becomes a metaphor for his journey through life and how he needs to look to God for help. And it's quite a literal psalm of ascent in that sense. And in those days, they would place what they would call a pole or a statue to the Asherim god, one of the gods at the time. They would often place those up on the hills. So a lot of commentators have also said this references, the reference to looking to the hills was, do you look to the other gods for help? Do you look to the things that, really those other gods were things made with human hands, with our own hands? Or do you look to the God, the maker of heaven and earth, who is all powerful, for help? Now, obviously, we don't relate to an Asherim pole on a hill. That holds no power or sway over us. But the things that maybe we've made with human hands that we could relate to, what are those in our lives? For each of them, for each of us, it'll be a slightly different thing. We spoke about the blessings last week and the week before, how Mark and Tomo shared with us how when you... You place your faith in God when you plant yourself like a tree along the river of living water, you can be evergreen. The leaves never wither, and in season we bear fruit because we delight ourselves in the law of the Lord. And there is, and the Bible says we'll prosper. Like Mark said, there'll be that shalom over us. We'll have the goodness of God, like Gideon, who he called out from the winepress. God will bless and carry you forward. And as God blesses you and carries you forward, it's important for us not to take our eyes off the blesser onto the blessing. It's a temptation to find comfort and strength in the things you surround yourself by as he blesses you. Whether it's a marriage or your children or success career-wise or the safety of knowing that you can retire comfortably. All those things can offer comfort and strength, but they cannot be where our help comes from. They cannot be the thing that'll keep our life, the thing that'll keep us from evil. Only an all-powerful maker of heaven and earth can do that. An all-powerful and all-watchful maker of heaven and earth. That's what the psalmist goes on to say. He says, you neither slumber nor sleep. He's everywhere and he's all-knowing. He's ever watchful and he's all-powerful, and he has the capacity to keep us, to hold us, to keep our lives. He is willing and able to stop our foot from our ankle from being moved, our foot from being moved. He wants to help us on our journey. He wants to make it easier on our journey. He wants to be the shade on our right hand. You can see in that picture of as they're climbing up in the hot sun in the arid conditions, he makes it easier, our journey. He wants to ease our journey. Like Jesus says, the burden is light in him. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. That's the God who we serve. He wants to take us through those hard times with an ease and a grace. And that's really my first encouragement, is that we look to God. And what does that picture look like? What does help for the journey look like? That word shade, I'm going to kind of take us down this junction. That word shade is also used in Psalm 91. Right at the start, we translate it as shadow, T-S-E-L in Hebrew. It's a picture of protection from the harsh elements. And Psalm 91 starts, he who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. That's where we want to be found. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the fowler's snare and the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions. It's a picture of an eagle. And under his wing you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. A buckler is just a small shield. You will not fear the terror of the night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence. A better word for us to understand is pandemic there. Nor the pandemic that stalks in darkness, nor the destruction that wastes at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side, 10,000 at your right hand, but it will not come near you. You will only look with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked, because you have made the Lord your dwelling place, the Most High, who is my refuge. No evil shall be allowed to befall you, no plague come near your tent. For he will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. On their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the adder, the young lion and the serpent you will trample underfoot. There's a boldness, a courage, and a translation into strength here. And this is the bit that I want to spend some time on here in Psalm 91. Because he holds, this is God speaking back to the psalmist, because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and honor him. With long life, I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. It's almost like as we're looking to God for help, what does it mean to trust him? And the psalmist in these last few verses is laying out like an ideal of what trust could look like or should look like. Firstly, he says in verse 14, he holds fast to me in love. Because he holds fast to me in love, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. Those aspects sound very similar to Deuteronomy 6:5, with Jesus' references, when they ask him, what's the greatest commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. He holds fast to me in love. All your soul and all your strength and with all your mind. So soul and strength. He calls to me as an action. I'll answer him. I'll be with him in trouble. And all your mind, because he knows my name, I'll protect him. So similar threads. There's a this picture of holding fast to God in love, this picture of loving God is so central. It's the greatest commandment. It's the starting point. And that's why I want to bring us back to this at the start of the year. And just to get our reference and our bearing from this, because nothing else matters compared to this. This picture is what Jesus points us towards. And this picture of loving God with all these different aspects of our life is really, shouldn't be viewed as different the compartments of our life, but in essence, the whole of our being wholly devoted to God. So all of these are different parts of what makes up a whole of us, who we are. And God's call is for devotion to him entirely across our being. And so I want to speak a bit to that part of holding fast to him in love. And how do we build that? How do we engender that in our lives? Are there things that we can do? And some of the things around just, another way of phrasing this might be to delight ourselves in the Lord. So we need a sure foundation, a sure faith based on a reasonable and solid understanding of who God is, and that we put our faith in him, that we walk that out, that there's action to it. In terms of heart, love, loving him, there's this delight that we can find in God. And how do we engender that? How do we build that in our lives? How does it become a culture in us? Or how do we nurture it? And some things that are thought about along those lines are, one of the primary things we need to do is just have gratitude. Spend time acknowledging and appreciating all the things that God has given us. Every one of us have things to be grateful for. Every one of us have a reason for gratitude. The breath in our lungs, the provision in our lives, his goodness. The big things in life and the small things. The things that are new in our lives, that have just come into our lives, and the things that are old, that we don't want to take for granted. We're like kids too, you know? Kids take you for granted. We can be like kids. We take our Father for granted to remind ourselves that we need to just be thankful for everything he's given us, and to create a culture of that. And I was reminded this week when I met with someone, he said, have you had a chance to write down the things you're grateful for? I said, actually, I haven't yet this time. I need to do that. I need to write them down, actually. So that's my first encouragement to you, to exercise or practice gratitude. The second thing that I wanted to remind us about is to build a sense of wonder, build a sense of awe. Wonder, a good friend of mine reminded me of the value of wonder. And what it'll do to building our delight in God. As we just wonder, we can wonder at his creation, the magnitude of it, the microscopic detail of it, the beauty of it. And that's where I just want to thank the team for the song this morning and how it drew us into that place of wondering at God's creation and Jesus and who he's done. We can wonder at his works, at the incredible work of Jesus and the significance of it, the importance of it, the impact it's had on history. We can wonder at the attributes of our mighty King, his all-powerful nature, his all-knowing and all-seeing nature, his goodness over us, his kindness, his loving mercy. There's so much for us to engender that sense of wonder in our own lives. And what happens is stress robs us of the room to wonder. Busyness and stress and demands can press that out of our lives, and we just get focused on tasks, don't we? But to create space, like Tomo was saying last week, for meditation, and to create space to allow ourselves to be filled with wonder again. When we've been through tough times, I understand that it's not what you feel like doing, but we need to try and rebuild this in ourselves, to delight ourselves in God, that we can hold fast to Him in love. Not out of duty, but out of delight. And I want to just read something from an author, Brian Doyle. I wouldn't turn to him as someone for theology, but I do think he understands the value of wonder. And so that's why I just wanted to kind of take us here, if that's all right. So, Joyous Voladoris. Consider the hummingbird for a long moment. A hummingbird's heart beats 10 times a second. Hummingbird's heart is the size of a pencil eraser. Hummingbird's heart is a lot of the hummingbird. Joyous Voladoris, flying jewels. The first white explorers in the Americas called them, and the white men had never seen such creatures, for hummingbirds came into the world only in the Americas, nowhere else in the universe. More than 300 species of them whirring and zooming and nectaring and humming time zones 9 times removed from ours, their hearts hammering faster than we could clearly hear if we pressed our elephantine ears to their infinitesimal chests. Each one visiting 1,000 flowers a day, they can dive at 60 miles an hour, they can fly backwards, they can fly more than 500 miles without pausing to rest. 500 miles, this tiny, I mean, yeah, exactly. Engender a bit of wonder in you. But when they rest, they come close to death. On frigid nights, or when they are starving, they retreat into torpor, their metabolic rate slowing to a 15th of their normal sleep rate, their hearts sludging nearly to a halt, barely beating, and if they are not soon warmed, if they do not soon find that which is sweet, their hearts grow cold and they cease to be. Consider for a moment those hummingbirds who did not open their eyes again today, this very day, in the Americas, bearded helmet crests and booted racket tails, violet-tailed sylphs and violet-capped wood nymphs, crimson topazes and crown-purple fairies, red-tailed comets and amethyst wood stars, rainbow-bearded thornbills and glittering-bellied emeralds, velvet-purpled coronets and golden-bellied star-frontlets, fiery-tailed orbals and Andean hill stars, spatial tails and pufflegs, even the most amazing things, each the most amazing things that you have never seen, each thunderous wild heart the size of an infant's fingernail, each mad heart silent, a brilliant music stilled. Hummingbirds, like all flying birds, but more so, have incredibly enormous, immense, ferocious metabolisms. To drive those metabolisms, they have a race car heart that eats oxygen at an eye-popping rate. Their hearts are built of thinner, leaner fibers than ours. Their arteries are stiffer and more taut. They have more mitochondria in their heart muscles, anything to gulp down more oxygen. Their hearts are stripped to the skin for the war against gravity and inertia, the mad search for food, the insane idea of flight. The price of their ambition is a life close to death. They suffer more heart attacks and aneurysms and ruptures than any other living creature. It's expensive to fly. You burn out. You fry the machine. You melt the engine. Each creature on Earth has approximately 2 billion heartbeats to spend in a lifetime. You can spend them slowly like a tortoise and live to be 200 years old, or you can spend them fast like a hummingbird and live to be 2 years old. The biggest heart in the world is inside the blue whale. It weighs more than 7 tons. It's as big as a room. It is a small room with 4 chambers. A child could walk around in it head high, bending only to step through its valves. The valves are as big as the swinging doors in a saloon. This house of a heart drives a creature 100 feet long. When this creature is born, it is 20 feet long and weighs 4 tons. It is way bigger than your car. It drinks 100 gallons of milk from its mama every day and gains 200 pounds a day. And when it is 7 or 8 years old, it endures an unimaginable puberty, and then it essentially disappears from human ken. For next to nothing is known of the mating habits, travel patterns, diet, social life, language, social structure, disease, wars, stories, despairs, and arts of the blue whale. There are perhaps 10,000 blue whales in the world, living in every ocean on Earth, and of the largest animal who ever lived, we know nearly nothing. But we know this, the animals with the largest hearts in the world generally travel in pairs, and their penetrating moaning cries, their piercing yearning tongue, can be heard underwater for miles and miles. I'll stop there. There's so much to God's creation, so much to his magnificence, so much to his majesty. We just need to take a bit of time, regularly, to rebuild that sense of wonder at it all. And that, I think, will stir a sense of delight in us that we can hold fast to him in love. And that's what the psalmist is talking about. He will deliver me because I will deliver him because he holds fast to me in love. The other thing to help us delight in God is to spend time with him, to get to know him. I touched on this briefly, but to just spend time thinking about the works that he's done for us, the gift that he's given us in Jesus. And as we learn about him in his word, we engender the sense of love in response to him, we edify ourselves, we build ourselves up. And we know that's mind and heart. I just wanted to focus on the heart aspects this morning. So let's look up for the lighthouse in the storm. Let's not be fixated on the waves around us. When I was 2 weeks ago at the start of this year, I just found I was thinking about the things up ahead of myself. I felt I needed to share this because other people might relate to this. I was just thinking about the things that I had to do in the next few months and what the year held for me. And without realizing it, I felt this kind of, there was a sense of anxiety building up in me. The sense of almost like an overwhelming, you know, can I do this? This is actually too much the demands on me. And after a few days, I realized that this was happening. And I had to just sit down and say, Lord, I need help for the journey. I need to hand this over to you. I need help for this journey. And I felt this incredible sense of peace as I did that, because he's our help. The maker of heaven and earth wants to be in that detail in our lives. He wants to be with you so you don't worry, so you aren't anxious, you aren't feeling overwhelmed. He is there for you. He's your shade on your right hand. He's your keeper, a keeper watching over you, your well-being. He cares about your shalom, your peace in your life. And as we look to him as our lighthouse, let's look to him for our help. Let's hold fast to him in love, and he will deliver us. Like Andrew said this morning, he will be our refuge. He will watch over us. He will come to us in our time of trouble when we call on him, because our hearts are toward him in love. We're holding fast to him in that whole being love, every aspect of us. Our minds, our hearts, and our strength, holding on to him. And for ourselves, for our families, for our church, that can we trust him for the circumstances for our church? Can we trust him for the circumstances for our families and for your own circumstances? So it's more of a heart message, not so cerebral, not such a head message. I hope you hear me this morning, and I hope it helps you find grounding for the year ahead. Tomo, can I hand back to you? Maybe a song of worship.